Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. May 8, 1945, World War II's VE Day, the formal celebration of victory in Europe. On the Eastern Front, gunfire would blaze on. In the Pacific, Japan would fight for months. But Nazi Germany had surrendered. Hitler's fascism in Europe was defeated. Across the Atlantic, in New York, Mutual Broadcasting rolled the news.
A bulletin from London. A French communique broadcast by the Paris radio said today that a truce has been concluded in the battle for the French Atlantic port of La Rochelle and that the Germans have returned 175 French prisoners. And, of course, you heard the earlier bulletin. The BBC recorded at 8.09 a.m. Eastern wartime a Radio Flensburg German broadcast quoting the German foreign minister as announcing that the German high command accepts unconditional surrender.
Unconditional surrender. Then, from the White House in Washington, President Harry Truman spoke to the nation.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
In triumph and honor, the Americans of that war and that day became the greatest generation. Now they are passing. 1,500 World War II veterans die every day. But their victory and their voice is still with us. Tonight on Point, the Allied victory in Europe 60 years on, and the war as it was understood and experienced by the millions who fought it. You can join the conversation. Are you old enough to remember that day, VE Day 1945? And old enough or not, what do you see today in the towering legacy of World War II victory? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be joined later in this hour by two veterans of the World War II fight for Europe. But first, from Stanford, California, we're joined by David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. David Kennedy, thanks so much for being with us. Wonderful to have you with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here this evening.
Hello, Tom, and hello, David. Great to have you on the show.
David Kennedy, there's so much we want to dive into about how Americans understood this war, but we'll have listeners tonight who will remember every month, week, and day of the final stretch of World War II in Europe. We'll have others who really won't be familiar with it. I wish you'd set the stage a little bit for, in broad stroke, between D-Day and here, what happened? How did we come to VE Day?
Well, in one sense, we might think of VE Day as the climax or the near climax of the 20th century's own 30 years war, a protracted conflict that breaks out in 1914, and the first chapter of which we know is World War One, and then this very uneasy peace between 1918 and 1939 in Europe when the episode that we know as World War Two commences. So it's a long, bloody struggle stretching over two full generations really brought us down to VE Day in May of 1945.
But more materially, so yes, the roots deep, and we'll look at that tonight. But that final stretch, you had the Russians, the Soviets fighting like crazy on the east. The Americans and British had come in on D-Day. They had moved slowly at great cost. And finally, by May, where did things stand?
Well, remember D-Day on June 6, 1944, in a sense, that's just 11 months, essentially, before the war's conclusion in Europe.
Yes.
So D-Day initiates the final phase of the war. It administers what you might call the quite bloody, but nevertheless, the coup de grace to Germany, Germany which had already by that point been seriously weakened and depleted by this awful, bloody conflict on the Eastern Front, which had been going on since the summer of 1941 between essentially the Soviets and the Germans.
The Soviets on the Eastern Front. What was the nature of the advance on the Western Front that led the German generals to step forward and surrender? What situation were they in?
Well, by the time the D-Day invasion force breaks out of the Normandy beachhead and begins this extremely rapid advance toward the German frontier, it's quite clear that Germany is caught in a vise from which there is essentially no escape, with the Russians closing in from the east and the British and the Americans and some Polish and French units as well closing in from the west. And the end is pretty clear, I'd say, by roughly August of 1944. But, of course, the Germans fight on for several more months, and there's some of the most awful bloodletting of the war on both fronts, in fact, Eastern as well as Western Front in that interval.
And then that march of events in the months just before VE Day, the Soviet troops come into Auschwitz, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin meeting at Yalta in February, Dresden firebombed February, Allies across the Rhine in March, Soviet troops to the gates of Berlin by mid-April, Mussolini, April 28th, captured and hanged by Italian partisans, Allies take Venice, and then the final countdown, the U.S. Army into Dachau, Adolf Hitler, April 30th, committing suicide, May 7th, 1945, unconditional surrender of all German forces to Allies. Of course, there's still some fighting on that Eastern Front where the Soviets were coming. David Kennedy, you've looked deeply into the origins of this war and the mindset and understanding of the war of the Americans who, in part, fought it. How do you understand what Americans saw as the fight when it was in progress? This war is used all the time now. It's so iconic. It's so towering. It's employed in many ways. Talk of Hitler, talk of the great battles for freedom and references to World War II. What about the Americans at the time? How did they understand it?
Well, first of all, I think one needs to remember that the generation that fought the war that has been memorialized ever since as the greatest generation, I don't mean to take anything away from them. They fought bravely, and over 400,000 of them made the ultimate sacrifice of their lives for the eventual victory. But it was also that same generation and the generation before them, in fact, their parents, who had been deeply isolationist right down through the 1930s and even into the early 1940s, even after the war in Europe had commenced in September of 1939, decided majorities of Americans continued to believe that the United States, as it were, didn't have a dog in that fight and were not terribly eager to get into the battle. Now, of course, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor changes that psychology very dramatically and very swiftly. But there was a lingering sense, especially amongst American leadership, that the enthusiasm of the people for this war and for an engaged international position going forward at the war's conclusion couldn't be taken for granted.
Of course, early on, Lindbergh, Henry Ford, friendly to Hitler's government, Joseph Kennedy, not that interested in seeing the U.S. get involved, and as you say, popular opinion in the U.S., isolationist for a long time. Philip Roth has written recently about this, of course, in fiction, a kind of fictionalized version, but reminding us of that mood. What was the origin of the American reluctance? And once Pearl Harbor flipped the switch and got the country fired up, was there some fundamental shift in understanding beyond simply the wound of Pearl Harbor and the damage there?
Well, the shock and the trauma of the wound really can't be overestimated. Not for nothing do we call the attacks of 9/11 a second Pearl Harbor and the psychological impact that they've had. It is a landmark date in American history because it conclusively demonstrated that the United States, however much it might wish to remain on the sidelines in this global struggle, simply would not be able to. Pearl Harbor had another effect, however, or at least momentarily potentially, and that was that it raised the possibility that the United States might be compelled, for reasons of the psychological pressure for vengeance and so on, to wage its principal battle against Japan in the Pacific rather than in Europe against Germany, which would have been a reversal of all the strategic thinking that had gone on before the war about if such an event should come to pass, what was the truly strategic adversary? And there was wide agreement. It was Germany, not Japan. And in fact, Winston Churchill, when he heard the news of Pearl Harbor, hurried to Washington, D.C. to make sure that the Americans would not renege on their prior assurances that Europe would be the principal theater of battle and the place the Americans would apply most of their resources. And he quickly discovered that the Roosevelt administration was not that rattled by Pearl Harbor in the sense that they would change the strategic emphasis. And that's why Europe remained the place where the United States very decidedly, calculatedly waged its principal war.
A gigantic two-front war. Jack Beattie, I'm looking here at photographs from VE Day. Times Square, a sea of people out. Very remarkably, it's shot from above. It's a sea of fedoras. Men certainly wore hats in 1945. Almost every head here. There's a newspaper being held up out of the midst of this sea that says, "Nazis give up." I see jubilation in these faces, but I also see determination. The war wasn't over. Japan was yet to be defeated.
Yes, and many soldiers were facing the prospect of being switched to the other theater to prepare for the possible invasion of Japan. And, of course, the worst battle of the Pacific War, Okinawa, was in store for the Marines who are an army who are already there. And so the sense of triumph and of victory had to be qualified by a deep lump in the throat that, my God, this thing isn't over. And we're fighting people whom, as the battle of on Guam showed, would fight to the last man and woman, for that matter, but would not surrender. So it was a great celebration, but there must have been a lot of anxiety there, David, as well.
Well, there certainly was, particularly amongst troops who were scheduled for that rotation from the European to the Pacific Theater, and there's lots of testimony from people in that situation when they're asked, and were asked in later years, their opinion about the justifiability and the legitimacy, the morality of using the atomic weapons. They essentially reply, "We never thought about it because it's immorality, because it got us off the hook of having to be in the Japanese invasion force."
And that's exactly what they wanted. But on VE Day, there was celebration. 60 years ago, May 8th, 1945. David Kennedy, please stick with us. Jack Beattie, we've got to take a short break here. Listeners, you can join us. Were you there? Did you celebrate VE Day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 60th anniversary of VE Day, May 8th, 1945, and World War II's Allied victory in Europe. We're joined tonight by David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Freedom from Fear, The American People in the Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. You can join the conversation tonight. Why were Americans initially so reluctant to join this war? What took so long? And what did that ultimate victory mean for the United States, for the world? What is the legacy of the greatest generation's victory, then? Is it enduring? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. On VE Day, millions of citizens flooded streets and squares in Allied cities, well, far and wide. Here's Edward R. Murrow reporting from a jam-packed Piccadilly Circus in London.
There was a time when our bomber boys said that you could walk on the flak when you were flying over the Ruhr, and tonight you could walk on the heads of people all the way across Piccadilly Circus. They're jammed absolutely tight. Now people are throwing confetti at me. I'm down on the sidewalk with a policeman here who is altogether inadequate protection. Now, we're just going to ask the policeman here what he thinks of the crowd and whether or not he has had any trouble. Has it been a fairly...
I think they're a marvelous crowd. A grand lot of people, not causing us any disturbance whatsoever.
No, we're just...
All I hope is you'll soon go home.
Famed American newsman Edward R. Murrow there in London's Piccadilly Circus on VE Day 1945. You can hear him saying it's so tightly packed you could walk on the heads of the people celebrating in Piccadilly Circus. David Kennedy, I wonder, just to stick with the beginning for a minute, because we want to get inside the minds as much as we can of the Americans of that wartime. If the Japanese had not attacked Pearl Harbor, in your assessment as an historian, would the U.S. have joined the war against Hitler?
Yes, I think they would have. And in fact, the United States was all but a combatant, I think, as of the spring of 1941, when Roosevelt convinced the Congress and the public to support the so-called Lend-Lease Act, by which we began to put America's very considerable economic and financial strength behind the Allied cause. That was, and Hitler called it, a virtual act of war, and that was correct. So I think even absent the Pearl Harbor attack, the moment was inevitable when the United States would join in the conflict in Europe. Without the Japanese attack, it probably would have been a little messier to find the kind of point of entry that would have had the psychologically unifying effect that the Pearl Harbor attack did. So there might have been more dissent, as there had been in World War I, for example, when 56 senators and representatives voted against the war resolution. Only one representative voted against the war resolution in 1941. But I think strategically the United States was all but in it as a combatant as of the spring of 1941.
Every war has to be packaged in some way to the nation that's going to fight it. Hitler and Tojo in great degree made that easy. But how was it presented to the American people? Again, beyond the insult and wound and offense at Pearl Harbor, the kind of conceptual framework for the war that was put before the country.
Well, first of all, among the reasons why the Americans felt so detached and uninterested in this for such a long time is because they felt very sheltered by the two oceans and long distance from the fighting and not particularly involved with any of the countries that eventually went to war. So Roosevelt, like Wilson before him, was challenged to find a basis to justify the case for war to the American people. And that was a long effort on Roosevelt's behalf to educate the public about America's long-term interest here. One of the landmark events in that process was, of course, the promulgation of the so-called Atlantic Charter in the summer of 1941, which is an Anglo-American statement of very broad and, I dare say, very progressive or liberal peace aims, embracing free trade and self-determination and the eventual completion or inauguration of the United Nations, making mention of human rights as the securing of which was a war aim. So Roosevelt, to a degree, emulated Woodrow Wilson in finding the most idealistic and moral grounds on which eventually to justify the case for war.
Jack Beattie, when you look back at that case for war, how it was interpreted, how it resonates today, what do you see?
Well, there is a kind of trick of perspective, isn't there? I mean, to us, the Second World War looms up above all as the war of the Holocaust. And we see the transcendent sort of challenge to European, to Western civilization that evil event posed. That in some sense, all of Western history had been making for that. Anti-Semitism had been dormant sometimes, heated up others, but it had been there, a curse for so long, and now the curse was out there. So the elimination of that, the stopping of that, the war against that, to us, looking back, looks like sort of the transcendent meaning of the Second World War. But I'm not clear that that was the way people who were fighting it saw it, David.
How about it, David Kennedy? Dwight Eisenhower entitled his memoir about the war crusade in Europe. What was it a crusade against or for? How did he see it? How did GI see it at the time?
Well, going in, I think it was principally a crusade against Nazism, including its racialist theories, and a crusade against the Nazi attempt for world power. But the event that we know as the Holocaust, strictly speaking, hadn't really begun yet when the United States entered the war in December of 1941. The Holocaust, if by that we understand the death camps and industrial-strength genocide against Europe's Jews, really only begins the following year, 1942. So though Nazi policies of hostility toward Jews were well understood, even as early as 1933, for that matter, when Hitler first came to power, the Holocaust or rescuing Europe's Jews or striking a blow against Nazi anti-Semitism was really not a very large part of the motivation or the understanding of this country, of the Americans, for getting into the war in the first place. But I agree with Jack Beattie that in memory the revelations of the ghastly horror of the Holocaust at war's end have cast a kind of an aura over our memory of the war, and it's easy to understand the war in retrospect as a war to avenge the Holocaust and put a stop to it.
So at the time, then, was it seen primarily as a material power struggle between great powers? Was it seen in the forefront of people's minds as a political struggle between political systems?
Well, I'd say mostly understood as a political struggle between systems, again, particularly with reference to the European War, where Americans did not have the concrete insult of something like Pearl Harbor to rationalize what they were doing. And indeed, this was part of Roosevelt's ongoing task, was to sustain the sense that the war in Europe, the major war, the major fraction of America's war effort against Nazi Germany, was justified in America's long-term interest. And he put that case mostly on the ground of creating a post-war world in which these kinds of challenges to peace would not be so easy to accomplish. And in that, again, he resembled Woodrow Wilson. So in both cases, World War I and World War II, Wilson and Roosevelt, you see American presidents waging war, asking the American people to wage war, not because of any immediate threat to their territory or some colonial interest they might have had, but for purposes of changing the character of the international system to, in Woodrow Wilson's phrase, make the world safe for democracy.
A Wilsonian impulse there, and also language. I couldn't help but hear it in the clip from President Harry Truman that we heard, where here this tremendous victory over Nazi Germany is won, and he's very straightforward in saying that they've surrendered to the United Nations. That's taken on a kind of an antique air, the kind of idealism embedded right there. David Kennedy, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation a veteran of that war who was still in theater on VE Day 1945. We're joined from Decatur, Illinois, and honored to be so by William Hanks. He's an 84-year-old World War II veteran. He was tech sergeant in U.S. Army Company C, 309th Infantry Regiment, 78th Infantry Division. He was 20 years old when he joined the Illinois National Guard for a one-year stint in March 1941, but that's not the way things worked out. William Hanks, thank you very much for being with us tonight, sir. Mr. Hanks, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight, William Hanks. We're grateful to have you. I wonder if you can remember exactly where you were and what you were thinking on VE Day in 1945.
I can't hear you.
I was just asking if you recall where you were and what you were thinking on VE Day 1945.
When the Germans surrendered?
Yes, sir.
I was in the 167th 10th Hospital at Cherbourg, recovering from shrapnel wounds.
So you were in a hospital bed. Was there a celebration in the hospital?
Yes. In fact, it was the nurses and the doctors went in and got us a supply of alcohol, and they cut it with orange juice and gave us all a glass apiece.
And there was the celebration. You went into the National Guard for a one-year stint. You didn't come home for 4 years, four months, and 10 days.
Right.
That's a long time. Did you think it would ever end?
No, I didn't. I thought, in fact, when I have finally recuperated enough to go back up to my unit, I was dreading to go back up.
Because
I just hated the thoughts of going back into combat again.
You were crossing the Rhine, or after crossing the Rhine in March of 1945, you were on a farm near Frankenforst when you were preparing to attack another town. How were you wounded, William Hanks?
My platoon sergeant had told me to take my squad out into a barn at Frankenforst. And the barn was at the far edge of the town. And I told him it was too open. I didn't like going out there. He said, well, that's all right. You won't be there very long with that, because we're going on over and we're going to take the town of Steeldorf. Anyway, I went ahead and took my squad out there, and it wasn't 10 minutes until a German started dropping mortar rounds right through the top of that barn. And right away, I was hit with shrapnel. My BAR man was hit, and 7 of my men were killed.
Heavy, heavy injuries right away. William Hanks, when did you finally make it back to Decatur, Illinois? And what did you find there when you got home?
Well, when I finally returned home, it was on the 15th day of July. And I was so glad to get home, I walked all the way from the train station about 4 miles west of Decatur to my home.
And Decatur is pretty hot in July. I know it well.
Beg your pardon?
And Decatur is pretty hot on a July day.
Yes, it is. When I got home, I found out that my twin brother had went into the Navy, and both of my parents had passed away.
Wow. While you were gone.
Hmm. While I was gone. So it wasn't too good a homecoming.
Sergeant Hanks, do you recall during the war, what did you think you were fighting for? What was in your heart in this fight?
I can't hardly hear. You're fading out.
Yes. During the war, what did you believe you were fighting for?
I still can't hear you.
Well, I'm sorry about that. It's tough to come through. I'll ask once more. In the war,
you're way out. Oh,
okay. Well, maybe we're fading away there, and I'm sorry for that. But it seems like our line is fading a bit. William Hanks, we're very grateful to you for your time tonight and for giving us a glimpse of your time there at the end of the fight in Europe. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, sir.
You're very welcome.
William Hanks, Tech Sergeant, U.S. Army Company C, in a tent hospital in Cherbourg, France at the end of the war. A little alcohol and orange juice, David Kennedy, on that day as he recovered from his shrapnel wounds. And I'm sure there were many wounded Americans. And how many still in uniform in Europe at that time?
Oh, several million. And all of them, I'm sure, shared Sergeant Hanks' jubilation that they would not have to go back into that dreaded frontline combat situation. But, you know, Sergeant Hanks just said something else that made me think about what it meant to him to go home. And clearly for him, though, he got a rude awakening when he got there, learning about his brother and his parents.
Yes.
But I got the sense that his expectation that home was a refuge and a shelter and a place that was safe from all the ravages of combat. And it reminds me that of all the countries that fought the war, the United States was really the only one where one could comfortably assume that home was a refuge. Everywhere else, the war visited its destruction on civilians in at a wholesale level, millions of European civilians killed, and for Asian civilians too, for that matter. Not so in this country. And in a sense, America's war was different in that respect, that very important respect, from the war that everybody else fought.
A real refuge once you got there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack B.D., David Kennedy makes the point, and I've read him citing the 100,000 British civilians who died during the war, the 6 million Chinese, the 16 million Russian civilians, leaving aside another 8 or 10 million Russian Soviet soldiers, I should say. It was a very different picture on the American war front, but also very different from war today. There was sacrifice at home, if not mass death.
Oh, indeed, there was. In one of his fireside chats, I think right as the war opened, President Roosevelt said, I regard paying taxes as a privilege. You are privileged to pay higher taxes to defend your country today. And there was a famous Irving Berlin ditty that David quotes of, you know, I paid my taxes today just like John D. Rockefeller. What did you do? So the whole people were sacrificing in their taxes and the way they lived with rationing and so on. And therefore feeling that it was total war, they were part of it. But, you know, I have often wondered about just what David said, that we were unscarred in that way. And I wonder if, the fact is we have been to war many times since, at least several times since. And I'm just wondering to what degree the Americans' readiness for foreign adventure partly, and now our disharmony with Europe, which seems to remember very well what total war means. I'm wondering just if how that, you know, is almost not licensed war, but made it more thinkable for Americans. What do you think about that, David?
Well, I think you're substantially correct, and again, it's among the reasons why the terrorist attacks of 9/11 were such a shock, because they were so anomalous in the context of America's entire historical experience. We've never had a foreign soldier on our soil since the War of 1812. The civilian death toll in the United States, in the 48 continental states of that era, the states that had a star on the flag at that time, the number of civilian deaths attributable to enemy action is exactly six people. You can count them on two hands. And that the difference between that and, Tom, as you said, the 16 million Soviet dead and so on is just astronomical.
Safety at home. Big sacrifice, though, on the war front in Europe. David Kennedy, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the 60th anniversary of VE Day, May 8th, 1945. You can join us. Is the war on terror this generation's counterpart? Or are these wholly different challenges? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 60th anniversary of VE Day, May 8th, 1945, about how that war and that victory shaped America and the world, the United States, and the great fight against fascism. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Is full national mobilization in war, total war, a thing of the past as we look at the way wars are fought today? And what about fascism? Dead and gone, still a threat? Where do you see it? What's the message that rings down to us today from VE Day 1945? We're joined tonight by David Kennedy, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author of Freedom from Fear. Jack Beatty is with us as well. And right now, from Buena Park, California, Walter Ehlers joins us. He's an 83-year-old World War II veteran and Medal of Honor recipient. Was a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army, 18th Infantry, 1st Infantry Division. Walter Ehlers, thank you for joining us tonight, sir.
Thank you.
I wonder if you can recall exactly where you were on VE Day 1945.
On VE Day?
Yes, sir.
I was in on the border of Czechoslovakia on VE Day near Schweinfurt, Germany.
Were you still fighting? Was it calm where you were? How did you mark the day?
That's the day that the war ended. It happened to be on my birthday, May the 7th of 1945, which was, I turned just turned 24. And, you know, it was the best day of my life.
Because it was over.
Yes.
You had
it's the best day of a lot of people's lives because it was over. We stopped fascism and Nazism, and we were just about to end the imperialism in Japan, so it was a great day. It started everything becoming to an end of World War II.
And I know when soldiers fight, famously, they're always first and foremost fighting for each other to save their own skins and to save their comrades. But do you recall, Walter Ehlers, in the midst of these battles, in the midst of the sacrifice and the fighting, did you have those political goals in your own mind and heart? Were you thinking on the battlefield, I'm fighting to stop fascism, to stop imperialism, to stop Nazism?
Oh, I definitely on Nazism because... I was going to high school, I was hearing about what was happening in Germany. We used to listen to the radio, and we heard about burning the Bibles and things like this. That began the whole thing right there. Mm-hmm. And then when they started taking children and putting them in schools and training them with Nazism and taking them from their parents and things like that, and if the child said anything about their parents having a gun, they'd go out and arrest the parent and put him in slave labor and take their guns away from them and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing went broke down to that, and nobody could put up a defense against anybody in control of the law, you know, that was being forced upon them. So actually, they were the whole country was held slayed almost by Hitler. Mm.
You and your brother famously went to war. It was June in 1944 that you got into this scrape that eventually won you the Medal of Honor.
We went to war, and we joined the Army in 1940, mm-hmm. and we entered the first time in Africa in 1942 with the 3rd Infantry Division, got transferred out of it to the 1st Infantry Division in Africa, and so we finished up the war with the 1st Infantry Division through Africa, Sicily, and then to Normandy. Mm. And we were separated in England because of a general order that said that any brothers serving together had to be separated when they were going into any severe contact situations with the enemy. And so they transferred me out of Company K to Company L, so I was in a brand new company when I just a couple months before I made the landing.
June 1944, June 9 and 10, you took out 3 machine gun nests in the hedgerows of Normandy. You came away from that decorated with the Medal of Honor, the highest honor. Recall a bit of that day for us, and did you think you were going to survive it?
I was really doing my job, and I never thought about dying or anything like that. I was more interested in living and getting and winning the war and making progress. You know, it's just I actually felt that I was doing my job, what I was supposed to be doing, and I knew what I was fighting for. I was fighting for God and country. There's no doubt about that, and sure I. You know, I was fighting to save my buddies and so forth. That's natural. That's mm-hmm. what you do mm-hmm. when they're all fighting for the same thing. And we were actually fighting the enemy for a particular purpose.
You eventually learned that the sacrifice had hit your family, that your brother had died on Omaha Beach.
They didn't tell me. I knew the first day that he was missing in action. The second day I knew that he was missing in action because I asked his platoon sergeant when I saw him, and he said he was missing in action. I knew that he had to either be wounded or killed in action. I didn't know which, but I knew he wouldn't be missing because he wouldn't go away anywhere. He was the best soldier I ever knew. And so anyway, you know, you can be the best soldier in the world, but one bullet will take your life. One piece of shrapnel or anything like that. It's the way it happens, and you have to have a heck of a lot of faith in order to continue on going and doing what you have to do. Mm.
But it means that you and your family knew not only victory at the end of this war, but the terrible sacrifice that the war entailed.
It is a terrible sacrifice, yes.
Walter Ehlers, when you look back, and you know your brother was one of many who gave his life in this war, and you look at the United States and how its role in the world since then, it grew enormously after World War II. It's very large today. Are you satisfied that what you helped win in World War II has been preserved?
I am very satisfied. We've freed so many people. You know, our military forces have never fought for anything but freedom from the time of the Revolutionary War. And we haven't fought an aggressive war. We've always been fighting for our own freedom, the Civil War, which was the biggest, and then World War One, we went over there to, you know, to save France, and then we went over there again, World War Two, to save the countries from, and to knock out the Germans because they were killing so many people and all of these things, and it continued to have been a domino effect, and we wouldn't have been here today if that we hadn't won that war. Mm. I mean, we would have had a lot of people in different places now. Mm. We might even be speaking a different language. But
And you were in the thick of it, and your
That's
family
right.
and your family paid a terrible family, price as well.
Yes, I had a brother that fought in the Pacific also. All three of us fought all 3 years of the war.
Did he come home from
yes.
the Pacific?
Yes, he did.
Oh, good for that.
But the casualty rate in the infantry is about just one out of three survives usually. It's hard to believe, but that's true.
Mr. Ehlers, we're grateful to you for your service and for sharing your memories with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Walter Ehlers, 83 years old, a Medal of Honor recipient for his service in World War II in the European theater. David Kennedy, you've written that how and why the United States fought and won a particular kind of war influenced the course of history. A particular kind of war meaning what in World War II?
Well, what I meant by that principally was that the United States, the testimony of people like Sergeant Ehlers aside for the moment, because he and his family certainly suffered quite a terrific sacrifice. But what I meant by that, particularly that passage in my book, was that essentially what I said a moment ago, that the United States fought a different kind of war from everybody else. It emerged. If you ask the question, who won World War II? Mm. And if by that question you mean, what country or countries emerged from the war in a better situation than they entered it? There's only one country that meets that test, and it's the United States. Even our partners in the Grand Alliance that participated with us in the defeat of Nazi Germany and eventually Japan, that is England or Britain and the Soviet Union, ended the war in a far worse condition than when they'd entered it. So the United States fought a good war measured against the standard of history, the United States' participation in the war and what the war's outcome did for this country was beneficial to a degree that history doesn't give us many parallels with it. You know, even in the way Sergeant Ehlers just talked about his own sense of what he did and his memory of it, I think in the annals of warfare, he's to be envied. He's to be honored for his service, to be sure. But he's also to be envied. His experience may not be typical of the average soldier over history. He was on the winning side, for one thing. It obviously comes easily to him to describe his motivation for fighting in the war as fighting for God and country. He's able to think of himself as a liberator. He's able to think of himself as having been an instrument in a just war, in a good war. Those kinds of privileged memories about combat don't necessarily come to all people who taste it.
And he came home to a nation that was essentially intact. There had been enormous sacrifices, but essentially intact. Looking back, I mean, you cite the numbers going into World War II, this astonishing effect of the Depression. 45% of white families at that time living in poverty, 45%. And among the black population, 95% living in poverty going into World War II. Quite a different picture coming out of that war.
Well, that's right. I mean, on the eve of World War II, we were still a deeply depressed country, not to mention a decidedly isolationist country. But World War II inaugurated what has been essentially a virtually uninterrupted 60-year, 65-year-long economic expansion of which every person in this country today is the beneficiary. You mentioned Philip Roth earlier, another of his novels, American Pastoral. Mm-hmm. He described the post-World War II American mood, and he said it was the moment of greatest collective inebriation in all of American history, a euphoric sense of victory in a just war, of victory well accomplished, of self-confidence, prosperity, growth, the baby boom. It was a very, very heady moment, but one that, again, the annals of warfare don't hold an awful lot of examples that are that wonderful.
Doesn't usually turn out that way. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bob is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Okay. Your guest earlier mentioned the isolationism in this country back in 41.
Yes, sir.
And I had two points I wanted to make about that. One was that a lot of the troops that went into battle were teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think teenagers ever had isolationism on their minds. The other thing was, you just sort of covered, in 1941, the United States was largely rural, and a lot of the rural areas had not recovered from the Great Depression, so people there had more immediate things on their mind than worrying about global affairs.
Mm-hmm. And they had trouble at home to take care of, and it took them a long time to take their eye off that ball. Bob, thanks very much for your call. David Kennedy, you write very specifically that the American government understood that there was a trade-off between the speed of victory and the economic impact of the war on the home front. I wish you could describe that trade-off and how they finally came down on it.
Well, the Roosevelt administration came to understand that the greatest asset that the United States could bring to bear in this conflict was the enormous industrial and economic strength and financial strength of the United States. So there were a series of decisions made to revise the original mobilization plan, which had been drawn up in 1941, even before we entered the war, and to scale it back, to mobilize a much smaller armed force than had been originally anticipated, 90 divisions instead of 215, which was the original target. And also to eventually a decision was made to postpone by almost a year the target date for the amphibious invasion that we know as D-Day, which, of course, takes place on June 6, 1944. Mm. The original target date for that operation had been July 1, 1943. And the decision to field a smaller force and to postpone D-Day by nearly a year, those decisions were made possible, as it were, by the fact that the Soviet Union was not defeated by the German invasion, the so-called Operation Barbarossa. The Soviets stayed in the field for a considerably longer period of time than the Western Front ran, and took enormous punishment, 24 million dead eventually, and it bought the time for the United States to fully mobilize its economy and bring to bear this tremendous weight of metal and flame that eventually backed the Normandy landing. Joseph Stalin had his own very cynical way of describing this American pattern of warfare. He said repeatedly, actually, to both Churchill and to Roosevelt, he said, "It seems that the Americans have decided to fight with American money and American machines and with Russian men." And to repeat that was a very cynical summary of this strategy, but it was also substantially accurate.
When you simply look at the numbers, 8 or 9 million Soviet military dead and a fraction of that American, but hundreds of thousands American. Jack Beatty, David Kennedy describes what he portrays as a very fortunate kind of war, ultimately, when you can come back to a homeland that's essentially unscarred. Yes, many dead left on the battlefield, but very bright prospects right in front of the country. I wonder how you see the legacy of this great victory still reverberating in Americans' view of the world, Jack.
Well, we've just heard it from President Bush. He was just asked yesterday by a Dutch journalist, did he see any parallels between today's situation and then? He said, well, it's a different situation, but there is evil in the world. There's always been evil. And I think the free world must confront it now as it did then. There's this idea somehow that America goes out and, fights evil. I just don't think that's how people saw it going into the war. It was about politics and world power and our survival and balance and all those things. And I think in a way that's an unfortunate legacy, this idea of Hitler was the incarnation of evil, a war against him was evil, therefore wars against people like that are against, evil people, and the United States' job is to do that. Boy, that's an awful lot to ask of a people.
David Kennedy, just 20 seconds here. Fighting evil, too much of a reductionism there?
Well, there is not now, and there never will be a deficiency of evil in the world. And if our long-run foreign policy is the extermination of evil, we're going to be at it for a very, very long time.
Well, but it was a big enemy in Europe and taken down, marked on this day, VE Day, 1945. David Kennedy at Stanford University, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us on this eve of anniversary. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Walking down a lover's lane, no. Walking down a lover's lane till you see me. When you see me marching home, then we'll go arm in arm and we'll sit down under the apple tree. Maybe just you and me when I come marching home.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.